Hello, and welcome to The Week, the magazine that describes itself as all you need to know about everything that matters. I'm Virginia Clifford Anders, your volunteer reader on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We share pages of headline news, political commentaries, personalities, and insights from across the U.S. and the world. We begin with the outline of sections and their current content titles. First, the editor's letter, which is by the editor-in-chief William Falk this week, and I've titled it The Legacy of Revenge. The main stories, Bolton's book, Royal's Impeachment Trial, and Coronavirus Cases Surge in China and Abroad. The last word long essay is by Steve Politti out of NJ.com, When the Coach Gets Sued. The People page, we had stories on Jessica Simpson, Michael Sweetney, and Stephanie Hull. From the political columns, we have from the U.S., David Leonhardt from the New York Times, The Absurdity of Letting Iowa Vote First. From the European Best columns, How They See Us, Mideast Peace Plan is a Gift to Israel. From the International Best columns, Auschwitz, Playing Politics with the Holocaust Memorial. There are three obituaries featured this week, Jim Lehrer, Terry Jones, and Frida Kaplan. And The World at a Glance brings us brief stories from across the globe from such places as Batesville, Maracaibo, and Abergren. So we begin with the editor's letter. Again, it's by William Falk, who is the editor-in-chief. The Legacy of Revenge. Shortly before taking office, President-elect Barack Obama faced a crucial question. Should his administration prosecute Bush administration and CIA officials involved in the enhanced interrogation program? Many Democrats were calling for war crimes charges, but Obama believed prosecuting his predecessors would be so politically divisive that it would consume his presidency. We should look forward as opposed to backward, Obama said. If a Democrat is elected president in November, a big if, he or she will face even greater pressure to go after Donald Trump, his top aides, and his company. The litany of possible criminal charges includes obstruction of justice, perjury, tax fraud, money laundering, accepting payments from foreign governments, and violations of campaign finance law. A year from now, the next president-elect may find it impossible to say, let's just move on. Trump has set a precedent that he may come to regret. With the help of Attorney General Bill Barr, Trump has weaponized the Justice Department against his enemies, with investigations into Hillary Clinton, a dead end, Andrew McCabe, James Comey, and other FBI and CIA officials. When Trump loses his presidential immunity to indictment, lock her up will not be forgotten. Prosecutors in multiple jurisdictions, city, state, and federal, will be salivating over the rich smorgasbord of potential crimes. Several Democratic presidential candidates have indicated that Trump team merits investigation, with Senator Elizabeth Warren promising to create a special federal task force for that purpose. If Trump is reelected, on the other hand, he'll escalate his demands for prosecutions of intelligence officials, Democrats on his long and growing enemies list, and former aides who have turned into rats. Back in 2008, many legal scholars and politicians from both parties argued that prosecuting people from the previous administration is un-American, something that banana republics do. How quickly we've devolved. Next, we have the main stories, and the first one this week is Bolton's book, Royal's Impeachment Trial. The publication of damaging details in former National Security Advisor John Bolton's new book upended the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump this week, creating a bitterly partisan showdown over whether Bolton and other witnesses would be called to testify. Shortly before the week went to press, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, told the Republican caucus he no longer had the 50 votes necessary to block witnesses, but was reportedly confident he would get them. He and other Republicans warned colleagues that calling Bolton as a witness might open the door to weeks of testimony Democrats could use as political ammunition, while not affecting Trump's inevitable acquittal. House impeachment manager Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, said that the truth was a subpoena away, while Representative Mark Meadows, Republican from North Carolina, warned that Republican senators who broke ranks would face political repercussions. The impeachment trial had seemed to be heading to a speedy resolution before the New York Times described explosive claims in a draft of Bolton's as-yet-unpublished memoir, The Room Where It Happened, which was sent to the White House on December 30 for a review of classified information. Bolton said he approached Trump in August about his concerns over $391 million in frozen military aid to Ukraine, and Trump told him the aid would remain frozen until Ukrainian officials turned over materials related to Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, and the Russian investigation. Trump defense attorney Jay Sekulow said Bolton's book was not part of the evidence gathered by House Democrats and was therefore inadmissible. Sekulow argued that removing Trump from office in an election year over disputed evidence and a vague charge of abuse of power would open future presidents to unjustified partisan impeachments. Danger, 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 Sekulow said. Bolton's revelations go to the heart of Trump's defense, said the Los Angeles Times. Trump's lawyers claim he froze the aid because of general concerns about Ukrainian corruption and his dislike of foreign aid, and insist there's no direct evidence that he demanded an investigation into his political rivals. But now Bolton is providing a first-hand account of Trump's own words, that until Ukraine announced an investigation of the Bidens, it would get no aid. How can a full and fair trial be conducted without Bolton's testimony? This is hardly a bombshell, said the Wall Street Journal. The rough transcript of Trump's July 25 call to Ukraine's president makes it clear he was asking for an investigation of Hunter and Joe Biden. Bolton is merely providing evidence that Trump made a direct connection between the aid and the investigations he wanted, which, frankly, everyone already assumed. That said, Bolton has certainly put Republicans in a tough political spot. They either have to allow new witnesses or hear Democrats shout cover-up from here to November. Will Mitch McConnell actually bet the Senate on Trump? Asked Charles Sykes in TheBulwark.com. The latest poll from Quinnipiac University showed 75% of registered voters, including 49% of Republicans, believe the Senate should call witnesses. If McConnell helps Trump by denying Bolton's testimony, he will endanger the seats of vulnerable GOP senators who are up for re-election in purple states in November, such as Susan Collins of Maine, Cory Gardner of Colorado, and Martha McSally of Arizona. Let's not pretend that Bolton is neutral of or free of bias in this affair, said Brad Palumbo in WashingtonExaminer.com. This is a man who spent 17 months as a national security advisor promoting a hawkish pro-interventionist stance that's at direct odds with President Trump's vision of America first. His claims should be taken with a grain of salt. How ironic that Democrats are now lionizing their former stock villain as a hero to the resistance, said Daniel McCarthy in Spectator.us. And let's not forget Bolton has a $2 million advance to recoup from a book that became available for pre-order on Amazon on the same day as the Times report. The Bolton revelations have forced congressional Republicans to pivot hard to a new talking point, said Rachel Bade in The Washington Post. No longer able to argue that there was no quid pro quo, Republican senators retreated to an argument from Trump's lawyer Alan Dershowitz that Trump's actions don't rise to the level of impeachment, even if the allegation is true. Bolton's revelations, said Peter Baker in the New York Times, sound like an echo of the so-called smoking gun tape that proved President Richard M. Nixon really had orchestrated the Watergate cover-up. But in the Trump era, the old rules no longer always apply. With unwavering support among a GOP base willing to dismiss any scandal as a smear by Democrats, the media, or the deep state, Trump has survived scandals that would have destroyed any ordinary politician. So will Bolton's bombshell prove to be just another brief-lived scandal or the moment that changed the trajectory of the presidency? In a sidebar to this article, What Next?, Republicans who feigned offense whenever Democrats intimate they are Trump toadies now are in a real bind, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Voting down a chance to hear from Bolton will make the Senate acquittal look like a sham trial. A refusal to hear relevant evidence would also deny Trump the exoneration he so badly wants. The White House won't be content to block Bolton's testimony, said Jake Tapper in CNN.com. It wants to stop the publication of Bolton's book itself. In a letter to Bolton's lawyer, a National Security Council lawyer said the memoir due in March contains top secret information and couldn't be published as written. Trump, for his part, attacked the book as nasty and untrue and an attempt to make money. The president also said that if he had listened to the hawkish Bolton, we would be in World War VI by now. This was the first of the main stories titled Bolton's Book, Royal's Impeachment Trial. The second of the main stories this week, coronavirus cases surge in China and abroad. Fears were growing this week that the new SARS-like coronavirus could spiral into a global pandemic as the number of cases continues to multiply inside China and abroad, despite Beijing's unprecedented efforts to contain the disease. More than 6,000 cases of the respiratory virus, thought to have emerged from a live animal market in the central Chinese city of Wuhan, have been confirmed so far in China, but experts believe the actual number is far higher. At least 133 people have died from the disease, which can be transmitted from person to person, and has surfaced in 19 countries, including the U.S., Germany, Japan, and Australia. To stem the spread, Beijing has implemented the largest quarantine in human history, putting more than 50 million people across 17 cities on lockdown and shuttering public transport systems and schools. Streets and stores in Wuhan, home to 11 million people, are deserted. It's just a ghost town now, said John McGorry, an American teacher in the city. At least 5 coronavirus cases have been confirmed in the U.S. All of the patients have recently visited Wuhan. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the virus currently poses a low risk to the American public, but it advised Americans to avoid all non-essential travel to China. American Airlines and United Airlines cut their number of flights to China, and the White House said it was considering banning all direct flights to the country. The whole world needs to be on alert, said Dr. Mike Ryan of the World Health Organization. The outbreak has exposed the vulnerabilities of China's top-down government, said the Wall Street Journal. While not as bad as the denial and inaction that allowed SARS to go global in 2002, Beijing's response has been substandard, and accounts from authorities seem to be changing by the hour. Local officials, fearful of being punished for highlighting problems, downplayed the early risk, allowing the outbreak to build. Now Beijing is playing catch-up. While China wrestles with the virus, the U.S. must do more than wait and hope, said the Washington Post. A crash effort to develop an effective vaccine is the first order of business. Second, we need to improve diagnostics. A test result currently takes 4 or 5 days. If infections spike, the result could be delay, chaos, and uncertainty. Hospitals should plot infection control measures and stockpile protective gear for workers. The investment in all this will be high, but less than the damages if preparedness is ignored. Don't panic, America, said Emily Baumgartner in the Los Angeles Times. Perspective is needed, and right now the flu, which kills 35,000 Americans a year, is a bigger worry. The new coronavirus seems to cause only minor symptoms such as fever and coughing in healthy people. Experts believe many people may have contracted the virus and had such a mild reaction that nobody noticed. All that most Americans need to do is wash their hands, cover their mouths when coughing, and carry on as usual. If China is serious about public health, it needs to ban wet markets, said Christian Walzer and Eileen Kang in the Wall Street Journal. At live animal markets such as the one in Wuhan, farmed and wild species from around the world are packed tightly together and sold for human consumption. Viral components are exchanged between species, creating novel viruses that can be transmitted from animal to human and later mutate so that they can transmit between humans. SARS is thought to have originated at a wet market, and now this new coronavirus, too. If wet markets are allowed to stay in business, another outbreak is inevitable. The Wuhan virus should be a wake-up call for Congress, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. Just months ago, researchers at Johns Hopkins ran a simulation of a hypothetical coronavirus spawned at a Brazilian pig farm, one that was treatment-resistant and, unlike the current virus, especially lethal. The result? 65 million dead in 18 months. The U.S. is the wealthiest nation in human history, and yet the CDC is spending a mere $500 million a year on emerging diseases. Humanity's luck in avoiding a deadly pandemic may hold up a while longer, but eventually our good fortune will run out. And that was the second of the main stories this week. Coronavirus cases surge in China and abroad. Next, we have the two-page essay supertitled The Last Word, which comes from any one of lots of sources. This one happens to be from NJ.com, and it's written by Stephen Polity. And for this publication is called When the Coach Gets Sued. John Suk sits with shoulders slouched and his head down at the defendant's table in courtroom 301, a stuffy wood-paneled space just inside the Somerset County, New Jersey judicial complex. The 31-year-old middle school teacher scribbles in a notebook as his reputation is shredded. The plaintiff's attorneys, in civil docket number L000629-15, have spent two full days portraying the co-defendant as an inattentive and unqualified lout. He is, they argue, a villain who destroyed the future of a teenager he was supposed to protect. He must be held accountable for what he did, one of the plaintiff's two attorneys tells jurors during opening arguments. The attacks intensify when Suk takes the witness stand to defend himself on a split-second decision he made 7 years earlier. He's accused of taking a reckless course of action that showed a callous disregard for another person's safety. He sounds like an awful person. Then you remember what Suk did to end up here. He instructed a player he was coaching during a junior varsity baseball game to slide. Not into an active volcano, not into a shark tank, into third base. I've come to Somerville ready to ridicule, but it doesn't take long for the gravity of the situation to hit me. If this jury of four men and four women decides Suk was reckless as a third base coach for making this most routine decision, who else will end up in courtrooms like this someday? What about the gymnastics coach who tells an athlete to tumble on a mat? Or the swimming coach who instructs a teenager to dive into a pool? Who will sign up for these coaching jobs knowing their reputation and livelihood might be in jeopardy? So yes, I have found the intersection of our overly litigious society and our out-of-control youth sports culture. As Suk sits there scribbling away, I am consumed with a sickening thought. If this JV baseball coach is found liable for telling a player to slide, there's nothing to stop the dominoes from falling everywhere around us. In short, we're all effed. Excerpt number 1 from March 9, 2016. Deposition. John A. Suk is questioned by Reuben M. Sinis, attorney for the plaintiff. Question. You did signal for him to slide to third base, correct? Answer. Correct. Question. Okay, what was the reason for that? Answer. The proximity of the ball to the runner approaching third base. Question. Okay, based upon your telling us that there was a play at third base? Answer. Correct. Question. Okay, how close was he to third base when you signaled for him to slide? Answer. Approximately 6 feet. Question. He was running at full speed, correct? Answer. Correct. Question. Giving no indication that he was going to slide, correct? Answer. He was running full speed around the bases. His eyes were not affixed on the ball. He did not see the ball coming. I did. Therefore, he was running full speed, but upon my decision and telling him at a safe distance to slide, he was able to do so. 7.5 years ago, Jake Messar was a 15-year-old freshman at Bound Brook High School and the best player on his junior varsity team. He already had made the varsity basketball team that winter, and given his talent and passion for sports, this seemed like the beginning of an athletic career that might go down in school history. Then came April 4, 2012. We will hear in excruciating detail what the plaintiffs believe Suk did and did not do on that day when Bound Brook played its first game of the season at Gil St. Bernard in Gladstone. Before traveling down that rabbit hole, let's review the facts not in dispute. The visiting team was leading 6-0. In the top of the second inning, when Messar, batting for the second time, laced line drive over the left fielder's head. Two runs scored. Mezar rounded second and headed for third, and next a sickening sound echoed across the diamond as he hit the ground. Pop! As Mezar wailed in agony, Suk rushed to his side. So did the player's father, Rob Mezar, who was keeping the scorebook in the dugout. An ambulance arrived. No one knew it then, but that promising freshman, two innings into his high school career, would never play another baseball game. I felt bad for my parents, Jack Mezar, now 22 and attending Rutgers University, testifies on the second day of the trial. They would never be able to see me play. Baseball was the least of his worries. Even after three surgeries, the ankle was not improving. One doctor even presented amputation as a possible outcome. Mezar needed two more surgeries, including one to inject stem cells into the ankle tissue, and he was fitted with an external fixator, a stabilizing frame to keep the bones properly positioned. The injury improved, but a surgeon told the once-active teenager to avoid high-impact activities, even jogging. It is more than a physical injury. Mezar has endured frequent bouts of depression and a pair of panic attacks, including one that sent him from a family party on Christmas Eve to the emergency room. All of this, to use a decidedly non-legal word, sucks. How can anyone sit here, listen to his story, and not have your heart break? Still, injuries happen. That is the cold reality of sports. Did the coach sitting with his head down at the defense table really ruin this kid's life? The game in early April was John Suk's first time coaching on the high school level. He was 23, still not a full year removed from Farley Dickinson University, coaching at Bounding Brook for just a few weeks after his predecessor abruptly resigned. He is 31 when he walks into courtroom 301. Do the math. The incident has hovered over him in some form for nearly a quarter of his life, always there, always grinding along without resolution. He was never going to lose any money out of his own pocket, but when New Jersey Schools Insurance Group, as the insurance company is called, decided to draw the line in the sand and fight the case to the end, he knew he was facing a day like this in a courtroom, eventually. But never for even a minute did I think it would take 7 years for this to finally get to trial, Suk says. He says he isn't worried as he walks into courtroom 301. Common sense, he keeps telling himself, will prevail. Surely the eight people in the jury box will see that this accident, as awful as it has been for the kid sitting a few feet away, isn't his fault. Right? But midway through the 2 days of testimony, I'll be damned if the opposite thought isn't creeping into my head. He's actually going to lose this thing. Excerpt number 2 from March 9, 2016. Deposition. John A. Suk questioned by Reuben M. Sinis, attorney for the plaintiff. Question. You gave him a signal to slide when he was approximately 6 feet from the base, correct? Answer. Correct. Question. And by your past answer, I take it that it's your position that being 6 feet from a base with a runner running full speed, that it's a safe distance to begin a slide. Answer. Yes. Question. What distance is not a safe distance for a runner to begin a slide? Answer. Any distance inside 2 feet. Question. There would be no reason for a third base coach to signal a player to slide into third base if there was not a potential play at third base. Answer. Correct. Question. Because sliding is dangerous? Defense. Objection. The plaintiff's attorneys are no rookies. Eric Kahn and Reuben Sinis were involved in another case in this century's highest profile case in New Jersey, representing one of the Rutgers students accused of spying on fellow student Tyler Clementi days before his suicide. Sinis attacks Suk's qualifications and points out he never took courses in baseball instruction in hitting, fielding, throwing, catching, or sliding. He grills the coach on where he was looking when Mezar was charging to the base, hammering home the point at the core of the plaintiff's case that Suk was focused on the runners going home, that he never looked toward Mezar until he was dangerously close to third base, that there was never going to be a play at third base, which means the slide was completely unnecessary in a blowout, that Suk pivoted and made the signal to slide at the last minute, too late for Mezar to adjust his body properly and causing the injury, that he knew sliding was unsafe and still instructed the freshman under his watch to do it anyway, that all this, when factored together, was reckless. We have established that the fence is 315 feet and that this is a JV game at Gill St. Bernard's, Sinnott says. And you've heard testimony that the Gill St. Bernard's team stunk. Is that fair? Sir, my opinion of their team has no bearing, Suk answers. Sinnott punctuates the grilling with a moment that seems stolen from a bad episode of Law & Order. He reads Suk's deposition testimony from 3 years ago when the coach said a slide was safe anywhere from outside of 2 feet. Then he approaches the witness stand and stands with his body pressed against it. I am now 2 feet from you, he says. It was your belief that a runner running at full speed from this distance that you could safely instruct him to slide into third base. Is that your position? By the end, the whole thing feels like an Abbott and Costello routine. Second base, left field, I don't know, third base. And I start to wonder if the jurors can follow the details. Then again, if they're debating blurry facts from a long-ago game at all, Kahn and Sinnott have managed to steer them away from the only thing that really matters, that Suk or any coach in any sport cannot be reckless when instructing a player to do something as routine as sliding into a base during a baseball game. When the foreman reads the verdict, not guilty, 7-0, 1-yes, I wait for a show of emotion, tears from the former baseball player, or a fist bump from the vindicated coach. Nothing comes. Mazar turns to face his father. Suk picks up his notebook. The lawyers shake hands, and the room clears quickly. From the moment Jake Mazar made that fateful slide into third base until civil docket number L000629-15 was resolved, exactly 2,625 days passed. Jill Deitch, chief legal officer for NJSIG, estimated the insurance company spent more than $75,000 in legal fees to fight the case, and that doesn't include the countless hours of work from her staff. That is the price of drawing a line in the sand. She already has used the case at a New Jersey State Interscholastic Athletic Association workshop called Legal Liability and Athletics. For Rob Mazar, Jake's father, the play at third base consumes him night after night, and he figures it will for the rest of his life. I ask him, was all this fair, suing a coach? He says he is a business owner who would never file a frivolous lawsuit. He believes his son was wronged, that too many of the facts of what happened on that ball field didn't come to light in the trial. He doesn't lay all the blame at Suk's feet. He wants accountability from administrators who gave Suk the job without, he believes, enough preparation to keep his son safe. What about the next kid? Who will protect him? You have people just taking the extra $8,000 who don't know what the hell they're doing, Rob Mazar says. Somebody's got to be responsible. Nobody is. Suk, meanwhile, couldn't wait to get back to his house and clear out the folders and envelopes full of documents he's accumulated. As he leaves the courtroom, his phone lights up with texts from curious friends. Well, any news? He answers a few on the courthouse steps. Then he sits with me across the street in an otherwise empty deli. He says he's surprised that jury took as long as it did to reach a verdict. I ask him to consider the other scenario. What would have happened if he'd lost? It's the end of high school sports, he says. The coaching profession would be under heavy scrutiny for everything that happens. Coaches are going to have insurance like doctors have for malpractice. School districts are not going to want to take the risk of having sports. He takes a long pull from his bottle of water. The case is closed. The weight is lifted. He checks his watch, shakes my hand, then heads off to find his car. He has to hurry. He has a baseball game to coach. I am Virginia Clifford Anders, reading from the current issue of The Week magazine here on your Sunsounds of Arizona Radio Reading Service. And that last piece was the last word, two-page essay titled for this week, When the Coach Gets Sued. We transition now to the People page for three brief stories on current personalities, Jessica Simpson, Michael Sweetney, and Stephanie Hull. Jessica Simpson remembers when she hit rock bottom, said Liz McNeil in People. It was Halloween 2017, and she and her husband, former NFL tight end Eric Johnson, were driving with their daughter to a school assembly. It was 7:30 in the morning, and I'd already had a drink, Simpson, 39, writes in her new memoir. Later that day, Johnson asked if she wanted to help her three kids put on their costumes, but Simpson says she was zoned out from booze and realized she wasn't up for it. "I was terrified of letting them see me in that shape," she says. She took an Ambien to fall asleep, then hid from her kids in the morning until they left and she could start drinking again. She summoned her friends for a self-imposed intervention. "I need to stop," she told them. She entered therapy, and "I started to go through all the depth of the pain that I was experiencing, much of which stemmed from being sexually abused as a child by a family friend." Simpson hasn't had a drink since. "There's no better gift I can give my kids," she says. "There's no better gift I can give my husband. More importantly, there's no better gift I can give myself." Most former NBA players might think they were too good for Michael Sweetney's new job, said Howie Kosoy in the New York Post. Sweetney, however, is grateful to be an assistant coach on the Division III Yeshiva University men's basketball team. At 37, he feels lucky just to be alive, having attempted suicide with painkillers during his rookie season on the New York Knicks. "I was on a billboard in Times Square and felt nothing," Sweetney says. "That's how dark of a place I was in." Drafted 8 picks after LeBron James in 2003, the former Georgetown University star was days away from reporting for Knicks training camp when his father, Samuel, died of a heart attack. "There was no time to digest it all," he says. "As an athlete, pride got in the way. I was fighting myself. I kept it hidden, and it became a snowball effect." Depression led to erratic play and compulsive overeating and ruined his career. His weight had ballooned to 370 by the time he played his last NBA game at just 25. After playing in basketball backwaters like Venezuela, Uruguay, and the Dominican Republic, Sweetney retired and finally sought counseling after learning his wife was pregnant. Now he gives speeches about mental health and is the only coach without a yarmulke at Yeshiva. He also coaches a girls' high school squad in New York. "To be happy and at peace," he says, "I wouldn't have thought it was possible." Stephanie Hull will always be known for getting the lowest score in Jeopardy history, said Dan Quass in Slate.com. On March 12, 2015, the lifelong Jeopardy fan not only won no prize money, she finished with a minus $6,800, and she was ruthlessly mocked online in very personal terms. "Imagine doing something that you wanted to do your entire life, and then it turned into that," says Hull, 30, now a philosophy professor in Sedalia, Missouri. By the end of the game, she was trying desperately not to cry and hasn't rewatched the episode since it first aired. She started off fairly well with several correct responses. "I'm actually proud of the first round," she says. But the second round turned into a disaster, with Hull missing one $2,000 question after another while trying to dig herself out of a deepening hole. If you've ever seen that GIF of Kermit flapping his arms, that's kind of what it was, she says. Total sheer panic. The low point came when she buzzed in for "Speaking This Way involves similes and metaphors." She answered metaphorically instead of figuratively. She didn't have to pay the show $6,800, of course. In fact, she was given $1,000 for finishing third. And she notes, "I live in infamy on the internet." That was a series of pieces for the People page on Jessica Simpson, Michael Sweetney, and Stephanie Hull. Next, we have the set of columns titled Best Columns. They're drawn from the presses of the U.S., European, and international arenas. There's 3 offered for each section, and I choose one from each to share with you. We begin with David Leonhardt out of the New York Times, "The Absurdity of Letting Iowa Vote First." "Iowa and New Hampshire should never go first again," said David Leonhardt. "The first 2 states to participate in the primaries and caucuses have an outsized influence over whom the Democrats and Republicans select as their presidential nominees, even though they are strikingly whiter, older, and more rural than most states. Iowa and New Hampshire are 87% non-Hispanic white, which is roughly what the United States was in 1870. Neither state has a city with more than 250,000 people. By voting first, these two tiny states play a major role in winnowing the field and setting the narrative of the race. One study, in fact, found that Iowa's and New Hampshire's voters have up to 20 times more influence than citizens in later voting states. In insisting that they deserve their exalted status, both states argue that their voters take their civic duty seriously. So are people in later voting states such as New Jersey, Indiana, and Louisiana too dumb or lazy to make their own choices for president? After this election, both parties should rotate the first primary state every 4 years, mixing both small and large ones early in the calendar. Iowa and New Hampshire do not deserve special treatment forever. That was David Leonhardt from the New York Times with the absurdity of letting Iowa vote first. Now, from the International Best Columns, we have a compilation of commentary under the single title, How They See Us, Mideast Peace Plan is a Gift to Israel. The Trump administration lifted the curtain on its long-awaited Middle East peace plan this week, said Marwan Beshara in Qatar's AlJazeera.com, and the final product is nothing less than an assault on peace. Standing next to a gleeful Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House, President Trump presented his deal of the century, which will give Israel some 30% of the majority Palestinian West Bank. The Palestinians are offered not a state, but an eventual pathway to limited sovereignty over an archipelago of disjointed territories speckled with Jewish settlements. Israel would get all of Jerusalem, while the Palestinian capital would sit on the far fringes of East Jerusalem, physically isolated from the Holy City by the separation barrier. To receive this poisoned gift, Palestinian refugees would have to renounce their internationally recognized right to return to their homeland. As if to underscore the bad faith of the deal, its unfit author, Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, said that if Palestinians reject the offer, they will only hurt themselves, like they've screwed up every other opportunity that they've ever had in their existence. Palestinians must unite in opposition, said Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds in an editorial. Iran and Turkey have condemned the plan, but some Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, are pressuring us to negotiate. With protests erupting across Palestinian territories, it is vital that Hamas, the Islamist group that controls Gaza, and the West Bank-based Fatah Party consolidate national ranks to undermine the deal. This deal simply recognizes the reality on the ground, said Dan Shufrenton in Yisrael Ayom from Israel. For decades, the international community has envisioned a two-state solution, with a pragmatic Palestinian government controlling most of the West Bank. But no such government exists, and Palestinian children continue to be raised on delusions of destroying the Jews. Trump understands this and has created a plan that guarantees Israel's security. Yet his deal was written by and to be rejected by one crucial party, the Palestinians, said David Brin in the Jerusalem Post from Israel. That's because for Trump, this isn't a serious peace plan, but a strategic election ploy to shore up his support among evangelicals and right-wing Jewish voters. For Netanyahu, it's a diversion from the Knesset's vote to allow his indictment on corruption charges, and it is a way to court right-wingers ahead of March elections. Israel now has a once-in-a-lifetime chance, said Shimrit Meir in Yediot Aronoff from Israel. Trump has effectively given Israel carte blanche to annex the Jordan Valley and apply Israeli sovereignty over all its settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu says he will do that as soon as next week, never mind the backlash he surely received from Europe, the U.S. Democratic Party, and the Palestinians. If it isn't done now, it will never be done. That was the Best of the International columns, How They See Us, Mideast Peace Plan is a Gift to Israel. We now move to the European Best columns for a compilation under the title Auschwitz, Playing Politics with a Holocaust Memorial. The 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz should have been a moment for solemn reflection, said Sabine Müller in Germany's Tagesschau.de. But when dozens of world leaders gathered in Israel last week to commemorate the arrival of the Soviet army at the Nazi death camp, they used the occasion to grandstand and squabble. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, at least, said all the right things, Speaking at the Yad Vashem Memorial in Jerusalem, Steinmeier said Germany took full responsibility for the industrial mass murder of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust, 1 million of whom died at Auschwitz. "I wish I could say that we Germans have learned from history once and for all," Steinmeier said, adding that he couldn't because anti-Semitism is again on the rise. Last October, an armed neo-Nazi tried to storm a synagogue in the eastern city of Halle, killing 2 people when he couldn't gain entry. "The perpetrators are not the same," Steinmeier said, "but it is the same evil." These were worthy words, unlike those spoken by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who hijacked the commemoration for political ends. He urged world leaders to unite against his arch-enemy Iran, calling Tehran the most anti-Semitic regime on the planet. Russian President Vladimir Putin used his speech to wage information warfare, said Edwin Bendik in Politica from Poland. He began spreading lies in the weeks before the anniversary, absurdly suggesting that Poland was responsible for starting World War II, and glossing over the deal that Stalin struck with Hitler in August 1939 to carve up Poland. In his Yad Vashem speech, Putin didn't mention Poland by name, but claimed that the Nazis wouldn't have been able to build death camps without the cooperation of local people. Auschwitz is located in Poland. The allusion is clear. Poland's president Andrzej Duda, meanwhile, wasn't even at the Israeli event, having boycotted out of pique that Putin got to speak while he did not. Duda left a statement insisting that Poland was a victim of the Holocaust, not a perpetrator. "Both Putin and Duda demonstrate precisely the wrong way to think about the Holocaust," said Andres Brenzenstein in the New Zürcher Zeitung from Switzerland, "nationalizing it to immunize one's country against attacks. All European societies must look within to understand how the state apparatus can be mobilized for the purpose of genocide. Every year, there are fewer Holocaust survivors left to bear firsthand witness, and there's a growing concern that sooner or later the Shoah will fall into oblivion. That's why we must require all young Germans to visit a former Nazi concentration camp before graduating high school," said Rune Weichert in Stern from Germany. "One in 5 Germans thinks we place too much emphasis on the Holocaust. Those that are physically confronted with the crime, though, come away understanding that Auschwitz is not about history, but about preventing an evil future." That was the Best Columns from Europe choice, Auschwitz, Playing Politics with a Holocaust Memorial. Next, we have the page of obituaries, the 3 chosen for this week, Jim Lehrer, Terry Jones, and Frida Kaplan. Jim Lehrer, 1934 to 2020. Jim Lehrer was not in the entertainment business. The courtly Texan newscaster was famously understated, believing his PBS viewers wanted probing, even-handed journalism without the glitz and opining found on cable competitors. Lehrer co-anchored a nightly newscast with Robert McNeil from 1975 to 1995, then helmed PBS NewsHour solo until his retirement in 2011. Fastidiously unbiased, he moderated 12 presidential and vice presidential debates from 1976 to 2012, and scored interviews with virtually every candidate in that span, as well as world leaders such as the Shah of Iran, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, and Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. Although his viewership was dwarfed by those of network newscasts, Lehrer refused to be more of a showman. "If somebody wants to be entertained," he said, "they ought to go to the circus." He was born in Wichita to a working-class but entrepreneurial family, said the Washington Post. His mother was a teacher and his father a bus station manager who briefly ran his own bus line. The family moved to San Antonio when Lehrer was a boy. Inspired by Ernie Pyle and other World War II correspondents, he wrote for his high school newspaper, then studied journalism at the University of Missouri. After 3 years in the Marine Corps, Lehrer went to work for Dallas newspapers and covered the assassination of President Kennedy, said the Wall Street Journal. "The event had a profound effect on him," he said, "making him aware of the fragility of everything." Lehrer shifted to public television and in 1972 moved to Washington, D.C., where he co-anchored PBS telecasts of the Senate Watergate hearings with McNeil. 3 years later, they teamed up on the McNeil-Lehrer Report. "Lehrer was an oasis of civility," said the New York Times. Interviewing President Bill Clinton in 1998, Lehrer gently pushed back when Clinton denied having an improper relationship with Monica Lewinsky, asking, "You had no sexual relationship?" Without the need for ad breaks, his public TV program offered in-depth coverage of foreign affairs, science, even fine arts. Critics found it elitist and dull, criticizing Lehrer for not forcefully confronting politicians. He saw himself as a writer with a TV job, and indeed authored more than 20 novels, plays, and memoirs. Thomas Jefferson said a democracy is dependent on an informed citizenry, Lehrer said. I don't care whether it sounds corny or not, it's the truth. Terry Jones, 1942-2020. As a member of British comedy troupe Monty Python, Terry Jones helped spin a mix of silliness and surrealism into global success. Jones wrote and performed many of the best-loved characters in the sextet's pioneering TV sketch show and movies. He was a grinning nude organist, Inquisitor Cardinal Biggles, a projectile-vomiting diner, and a host of cranky old women. Perhaps the most famous of those was the mother in the 1979 religious satire Life of Brian, which he directed, who squawks at her son's deluded followers, "He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy." Jones could be erudite, as well as absurd. He wrote scholarly works on Chaucer and the Crusades and authored children's books and opera librettos. The term Renaissance man could be applied, though as a medievalist, he bristled at the idea. "The medieval world wasn't a time of stagnation," he wrote. "To believe that reveals our own ignorance." Born in Wales to a homemaker mother and a bank clerk father, Jones excelled academically and at just about everything else he tried, said the Times from the UK. He captained the rugby and boxing teams at his private school and was studying English at Oxford University when he befriended fellow student Michael Palin. The pair wrote zany and surreal sketches for Oxford reviews and, after graduating, moved to London, where they became fixtures of the booming TV satire scene, said The Guardian from the UK. At the end of the 1960s, Jones and Palin teamed up with four others working the TV circuit: Eric Idle, John Cleese, Graham Chapman, and Terry Gilliam, to create a new show for the BBC, Monty Python's Flying Circus, 1969-1974. With its absurdist sketches that often ignored the established rules of comedy, the Pythons eschewed punchlines. The show was a hit on both sides of the Atlantic, said the New York Times. Python grew into a mini-industry with books, films, LPs, and live tours before disbanding in the early 1980s. Jones went on to work on numerous TV and movie projects, including writing the screenplay for the Jim Henson fantasy Labyrinth. He reunited with his fellow Pythons on Broadway in 2014, by which time the word Pythonesque had entered the Oxford English Dictionary. "We want to be unquantifiable," Jones said. "This means we failed utterly." Frida Kaplan, 1923-2020. You might not know Frida Kaplan's name, but you've almost certainly tasted her legacy. The founder of wholesale firm Frida's Specialty Produce revolutionized American cuisine by persuading supermarkets to stock what were then exotic fruits and vegetables, including habanero peppers, fresh ginger, shiitake mushrooms, passion fruit, and spaghetti squash. The Los Angeles-based wholesaler's first big score came in 1962, when she got her hands on a batch of Chinese gooseberries from New Zealand and gave the fuzzy brown fruit a more appetizing name, kiwi fruit. It took 18 years for kiwi fruit to catch on. In 1968, one journalist likened them to furry green potatoes, but today they're a grocery store staple. "I couldn't compete with all the boys on the big items," Kaplan said, "so I built the business selling things that were different." Kaplan was born in downtown Los Angeles, where her Russian immigrant father worked as a pattern cutter for women's clothes, said the Orange County Register. She graduated from UCLA with a degree in political science and in 1956 went to work at a produce firm run by her husband's aunt and uncle. 6 years later, Kaplan launched her own business. At the time, grocery stores offered some 60 types of produce. The Kiwi Queen, as she became known, expanded those choices by some 200 fruits and vegetables. Frieda's specialty produce is now a $50 million a year business, said the New York Times. But Kaplan admitted that not everything she pushed succeeded. There were the fruit-flavored fortune cookies, she said in 2015, that only dogs in Dallas wanted. Colored walnuts were also a flop. I mean, we tried, she said, but now we're a little more cautious. And next we have the U.S. and the World at a Glance, which is a gathering of brief stories from around the globe, beginning this week in Batesville, Arkansas, with Owning Up. Hunter Biden agreed to pay child support to an Arkansas woman after a DNA test showed with near scientific certainty that he fathered her child, born in August 2018. Biden, the son of former Vice President Joe Biden, had been adamant in insisting that he'd never had sex with London Alexis Roberts, who says she met Biden in Washington, D.C. while studying at George Washington University. She also performed under the stage name Dallas at a D.C. strip club that Biden frequented, the New York Post reported. Biden, who's married, claimed he couldn't afford the payments, but he's now agreed to pay retroactive child support as well as Roberts' attorney fees. Reaching the child support agreement lets Biden avoid an appearance at an Arkansas court hearing scheduled for this week, especially awkward timing amid the Senate impeachment trial, which centers on Trump's push for an investigation into Biden's work in Ukraine. From Phoenix, voting discrimination. Arizona violated the Voting Rights Act by crafting election laws to suppress minority turnout, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week. The Republican-controlled state legislature banned ballot harvesting in 2016, prohibiting voters from letting campaign workers or other non-family members deliver their early ballots. Lawmakers said the charge would prevent fraud, but the Ninth Circuit ruled 7-4 that Arizona had contrived that rationale to outlaw a practice used overwhelmingly by Democrats in a state that has become increasingly competitive. The judges ruled that Arizona's long history of race-based voting discrimination and legislators' implausible claims about their motives demonstrated that the true intent of the state's regulation was to disenfranchise Latinos, Native Americans, and African Americans. The court also struck down a law that made ballot cast in the wrong precinct invalid, a rule that disproportionately affected non-white voters. From Richmond, Virginia. Too late? Virginia became the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment this week, setting up a long-shot legal fight to enact a constitutional amendment outlawing discrimination on account of sex. Congress passed the ERA in 1972 and set a 10-year deadline for the required 38 states to ratify. Only 35 states did so in time. Since then, 5 states have rescinded their approval. However, Nevada approved the ERA in 2017 and Illinois in 2018. Supporters of the amendment say states lack the constitutional authority to rescind their ratification. Last month, the Justice Department said the resolution has expired, and the National Archives, which certifies amendments, said it would follow that opinion. Virginia lawmakers refused to call the vote on the amendment, which was first proposed in 1923, merely symbolic. The 27th Amendment, which deals with congressional pay, was introduced in 1789 and finally ratified only in 1992. From Maracaibo, Venezuela, fugitive senator caught. Venezuelan special forces have captured the fugitive Colombian former Senator Aida Merlano, who escaped her prison guards during a dental procedure last October. Merlano, who was serving 15-year sentence for vote buying, was seen on surveillance footage climbing out the second-story window of the dentist's office and shimmying down a rope to an accomplice on a motorcycle. Her escape was an embarrassment for Colombian authorities, and the head of the prison where she had been held was fired for authorizing her treatment at a private clinic. It's unclear if Venezuela will allow Merlano's extradition to Colombia, which does not recognize the regime of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro as legitimate. From La Paz, Bolivia, not-so-temporary president? Bolivia was in turmoil again this week after interim president Jeanine Áñez, who took office following the October ouster of leftist President Evo Morales, announced that she will run for the nation's top job in May's election. Morales and his socialist party were forced from power after the military-backed protests against his fraud-tainted re-election. Áñez, a conservative former senator, promised at the time that she would be a placeholder leader until new elections. Now Anya says she's the only one who can unite a fragmented country. After her communications minister quit in protest, Anya's this week fired her whole cabinet and installed a new one of loyalists. From his exile in Argentina, Morales said that Anya's candidacy was proof he was the victim of a right-wing coup. From Abergreen, Libya, ceasefire collapses. Heavy fighting broke out between troops loyal to Libya's rival governments this week, obliterating the ceasefire brokered in Berlin just days earlier. The forces of rebel General Khalifa Haftar, who is supported by Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Russian mercenaries, seized the town of Abu Ghraib, which has been under the control of the United Nations-recognized Government of National Accord. That government, which has links to political Islam, is backed by Turkey, Italy, and Qatar. Haftar's forces also shelled the GNA-controlled capital, Tripoli. With the enemy's repeated violations of the ceasefire, the foe was rendering the ceasefire useless, said GNA military spokesman Mohammed Janonu. Planeloads of weapons were still being delivered to areas in Libya's east and south, which are controlled by Haftar, even though an arms embargo was agreed to at the Berlin summit. From Dehyak, Afghanistan, U.S. plane crash. American troops this week recovered the bodies of two U.S. service members who died when their surveillance plane crashed in Taliban-controlled territory in eastern Afghanistan. The remains were found near the crash site, treated with dignity and respect by the local Afghan community in accordance with their culture, the U.S. military said in a statement. The two-person Bombardier E-11 plane is an advanced communications aircraft that helps ground troops and commanders keep in contact, which can be difficult in the mountainous country. The plane went down in bad weather, and the Pentagon said there was no indication that enemy fire played a role. From Nairobi, plague of locusts. Billions of desert locusts are chomping their way across East Africa in the worst swarms that the region has experienced in decades. One mega swarm in Kenya covers some 930 square miles and could contain up to 200 billion locusts. Over the past few months, the insatiable insects have eaten at least 175,000 acres of cropland in Ethiopia and Somalia and more than 1 million acres in Kenya. Corn, sorghum, cowpeas, they have eaten everything, said Kenyan farmer Ndunga Makanga. Unusually heavy rains in October and November drove the population explosion. Locusts like to lay their eggs in moist soil, and when the rainy season begins in March, the insects' numbers could swell by a factor of 500. You can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio.